Welcome to Are You at Risk, a podcast from Minnesota Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company. Here are your hosts, Todd Scott with Joy Melvin Griffin and Kiernan Waters.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another Are You at Risk podcast. This is the podcast for lawyers. Well, anybody who's curious about the life of lawyers, and especially lawyers that struggle with, they may have a huge problem in their workload. We talk about things involving malpractice and all the things that can go wrong in a law firm. My name is Todd Scott. I'm the Vice President of Risk Management here at Minnesota Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company. And I'm with two of my favorite colleagues, Kiernan Waters.
Hi, happy to be here.
And Joy Melvin Griffin.
Hello.
Glad to have you guys back. We are again doing another series of podcasts, and we are talking about a lot of different things that we've seen over the past year that are trends and topics involving things that can go wrong in a law firm. This is the life. All three of us are attorneys that work in the legal malpractice industry. And sometimes this podcast gives us an opportunity to talk about things a little bit off the record that aren't, nobody's getting CLE credit for attending these podcasts, but you're getting a deep insight into what it's like in our world. So happy to be talking to you guys about this today. And so today, the topic has to do with judicial ethics and the ways that sometimes judges can get in trouble. Now, I know both you guys, Joy and Kiernan, have been talking about judicial ethics and judicial liability around the country. And I got to admit, when I went to law school, there was this thing called judicial immunity. I thought that a lawyer, a judge could never get in trouble, never get sued, and even the people that prosecute cases and all of that. But times change. And I mean, obviously, I guess the concept of judicial ethics has been around for a long time. They have their code of ethics that they are responsible for. But we are an insurance company. And so what is happening now that judges have to be concerned about liability and potential costly liability? So Kiernan, tell us why we're talking about this topic.
Really, you brought a bunch of threads together in your opening. So thank you for that, because when we're out at conferences and I bring this up, the question, people typically do a double take and they're like, did she just say judges can get in trouble? And it's like, no, yeah, we still do have the concept. It is firmly in the law that, you know, there is judicial immunity for their decisions. But at the same time, and in fact, in our last podcast, when we were talking about some of the issues related to ICE and immigration that are going on now, we mentioned a judge out of the Milwaukee Circuit Court who was just found, she was convicted of felony obstruction for the way that she handled a person in her courtroom who, you know, and kind of shielding them from some ICE agents that were also in the courthouse. And so she was convicted of this felony. And so far in her ways that she's looking to not appeal it, but she was requesting a new trial. And even that has now been not neglected. What am I trying to say here? She didn't get a new trial. The charges mm-hmm. continue to stand for her. So while there is judicial immunity, it is for civil lawsuits.
Okay.
On the other side of things, there are also, like with lawyers and our rules of professional liability or our rules of professional responsibility, judges too have a code of judicial conduct that they are supposed to abide by. So they have ethical rules that dictate how they should kind of reflect our justice system. And essentially, once a judge, your actions are always kind of judicial actions on and off the bench because you have such judgment, but also because you're representing the judicial landscape of the U.S., right? Your actions then reflect upon our judiciary, and we really want a robust judiciary that is above, you know, the kind of politics and gossip and all those types of things. We want the judge's actions to not be prejudicial against our rule of law. So separate from the criminal liability that they could face, like that judge in Milwaukee. Judges are supposed to abide by their rule of judicial conduct. And then we can talk in a little bit about how those judicial conduct rules are enforced, which is very state specific based on whatever oversight committee or commission is in that state. But I'll turn it back to you guys for a quick history lesson. What is the furthest back that you think that judicial immunity kind of goes? What did you learn in law school, or what do you remember from maybe your classes back then, if anything?
That's not fair. That's just not fair.
Well, I'll give you a hint. The first case that you probably learned in constitutional law was Marbury versus
Madison.
There we go. Okay. So Marbury versus Madison, was one of the first cases in the U.S. that cemented judicial immunity. And, you know, of course, our judicial system, what came kind of before the American judicial system? Does anybody want to hazard a guess there?
The British common
law system. Yeah. So, a lot of
I'm doing this. Joy, can you believe it?
I just want to know what our prizes are for getting this.
There we go. Starbucks all around after this. But so the British, they took things. Do you guys want to go further back? Anyone want to throw something out? It's kind of obvious, I think. Where did the British get some of their systems from?
Well, now I'm thinking Greek philosophers, but maybe that's too far back.
Well, all roads lead to Rome.
Code of Hammurabi. So,
there we go. I think that might be a little too far back, Joy, actually, but great. Yeah. And so I bring this up because the Romans had a concept of judicial immunity. And what I think is the most interesting thing about this is that for intentional judicial misconduct, things like a judge taking a bribe, the penalties were really harsh. So today, a judicial commission can sanction a judge. They can remove the judge from the bench. Under Roman law, intentional misconduct, such as bribery, death sentence.
Wow.
So it comes from a really harsh, really ancient kind of thought about law. And since then, it's certainly been changed and evolved, through centuries and through England and over to America. And we still have judicial immunity in the sense that we know it from Marbury and Madison. And there's many other cases, you know, in the years since then that have cemented that kind of the rule of law there. But the issue is that how do we keep judges from kind of acting badly and reflecting badly then on the judiciary? And so in the 20th century in America is when these kind of codes of conduct started to be thought of, started to be written out, and then finally started to be implemented. Although you might remember from a couple years ago that the first code of conduct for our Supreme Court justices was just made in 2023. So from the 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century, when these codes were kind of being first memorialized and were in place for federal judges since maybe the 70s, I think, but there was never a code of conduct for our Supreme Court justices until recently. There were some other means of kind of compliance, especially when it comes to like monetary disclosures, but the 2023 code of conduct, that was the first time a written code of conduct was adopted. There's really no enforcement mechanism. So if we look back to our own individual states, that's where I was talking about. There's a code of conduct, but then there's also an oversight body that enforces it. And so if a judge has a complaint filed against them for something that they did not related to a judgment they made, because there's an appeals process, and that's how the appeals process works in our court system. But if they were to show bias on the bench, if they were to yell at someone in their court, if they were to, there are so many things that the judges can do that would be against their code of conduct. And again, that's both on and off the bench. So certainly, you know, showing bias in your courtroom is one of those things. But having a DUI, say, or, being in public in some way or doing something on social media. I mean, these codes of conduct are incredibly far reaching because of the not only respect, but because of the role that judges play in our world.
Mm-hmm. I got to admit, I'm one of those people that when I'm trying to fall asleep at night, I scroll. All right. And I never wanted to be a TikTok guy, but my wife kept sending me TikTok videos. You got to watch this one. It's these dogs are so cute and things like that. And so next thing you know, for some reason, TikTok is a regular thing on my phone. But there's this trend now, and I didn't realize this was a thing, where judges will have like these cameras in their courtroom. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's like a double screen where one side faces them. It's like the camera in a car where it shows the people inside the car and the people in the traffic ahead. Well, in this case, it's showing the judge, but then it shows the people standing in front of the judge. And when things get crazy in the courtroom, it makes for good social media accounts. And some mm-hmm. of these judges are becoming a little famous. You guys, I don't know, do you ever watch any of that stuff or see those things?
There's that one really nice judge up in like New England. I'm not sure if he's Rhode Island or somewhere, but he seems to be just really caring. And I like his his takes on things. But it's really difficult dealing with, and this is a topic for another podcast, but the sovereign citizens that come into
yes.
the courtrooms. And
that's my favorite genre.
I'll never be on the bench because, no, thank you.
Is watching a judge deal with posse comitatus and sovereign Oof. Citizens. And when they start talking about the court has no jurisdiction, some judges are really good at dismantling that and all that. But anyway, but the point is, though, that the you know, so you're seeing some of these things, and sometimes you're like, wait a minute, this judge, there's one guy in Texas who he berated an IT guy.
Oh, this was just in the news recently. Yeah.
Have you seen that one?
But you know, he asked him to come back, or he asked an attorney to come back after criticizing the judge on social media. Did you see that?
Oh, no, I did not see the follow-up. Did that?
Did the attorney just reach out to the judge, or did the attorney actually file a complaint for judicial misconduct with the commission?
After this was an unrelated attorney. I don't believe he was in court at that time. He had just under a post, you know, he just commented, I hope this judge will apologize for, you know, his actions. And he has the judge demanded that that attorney come before his court. And what's funny is, you know, this is kind of going to jurisdictions that elect their judges. Mm. In Virginia, we don't have that. Our legislature determines who sits as a judge. But in these types of counties and localities where they elect, that judge only won by a very small margin.
Oh.
And those headlines have far reach. So what'll happen when they're up for election? Maryland has some judicial elections, and that really does change the landscape of kind of not only how the commissions work, but who fills the roles of judges, right? So it's an interesting aspect of it to consider.
Now that we've got cameras in the courtroom and people like me are sitting there watching it for entertainment at night, and then occasionally, I mean, you're going to have these judges who – I mean, could you imagine having a camera over your desk all day?
Well, every action as a judge is under such scrutiny. Again, whether you're on the bench where you're the highest kind of officer in that courtroom, but also if you, especially in areas where they're elected, you're out in your community, you're still a judge. People recognize you because maybe they've been in front of you. So especially with social media these days, I mean, this is a really kind of hot button issue across the U.S. for a variety of reasons. One, because of politics right now and how these judicial officer roles have become more politicized. Two, because of the scrutiny of, you know, social media and things that judges are doing in the community that reflect on their position and the judiciary. And three, a huge increase in complaints of misconduct against judges recently, partly because of the things I just talked about, but also because a lot of commissions are now accepting online complaints. So in the past, where someone who wanted to make a complaint, to file a complaint against the judge with whatever governing body oversees the judges in their state, they might have to print out a form and even have it notarized and then mail it in. And they might never hear of, you know, the update of whatever happened to their complaint. But nowadays, we have more states moving to an online complaint system. And where we've seen those online complaint systems, we've seen double, triple, or even more complaints filed against judges in the years following that. So now there's, and this is, you know, think about the transparency involved here. Like it's a good thing to have more people have access to make a complaint against a judge when that complaint is, has merit to move forward. Certainly most of the complaints against judges lack merit and really are not the right way to combat, you know, a loss in court, right? There's the appeals process for that. And so I think, you know, 90-something percent, I would even say 98, 99% of complaints made against judges do get dismissed and don't move forward with any type of investigation. But if there is a need to investigate, now you have that commission or the governing body, the oversight board, who goes through with that, and the judge then has to provide a response and defend themselves. And that's how we got involved in this, because we do attorney defense for this type of thing. And so now we started doing judicial defense if there is a claim that the judge has had some type of ethical misconduct.
Hey, just to let me clarify here too, obviously we're talking about things that arise out of bad judge behavior. But that doesn't necessarily translate into lawsuit. It sounds like it's mostly, you know, these are about grievances that are dealt with through
disciplinary processes. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It's a disciplinary process. The same way an attorney might face, here in Maryland, we have an attorney grievance commission for breaking a rule of our professional responsibility. So it's a disciplinary process. And our policy provides defense costs to respond to whatever the commission might investigate. And here in Maryland, we have a judicial disabilities commission, because not only is it for the code of conducts, because people kind of look at me sideways when I say it's a disabilities commission, but the commission can also investigate substance abuse issues, issues related to dementia and Alzheimer's. Whenever a judge is unable to fulfill the duties of their job, that's when the commission has the jurisdiction to step in and kind of handle the judicial officer, and again, could remove them from the bench in some situations. There are other ways that they can be disciplined prior to, or you know, obviously the worst is them being removed from the bench, the most serious, but they can be remanded to take trainings and go back and take other classes or have a judicial mentor provided to them. You know, there are other steps before a judge is sanctioned and removed.
And looking at the different ways various jurisdictions handle judges and judicial immunity, one of the things that Virginia does is a little bit different. Our equivalent of the grievance commission is our JERC complaint, judicial, and I'm going to mess up the whole thing, but it's our inquiry review commission. And essentially, that is where you can file a complaint against a judge. And like Kiernan says, you know, a vast majority are dismissed. However, there is another useful tool that I really appreciate. And our Supreme Court collaborated with one of the best institutions in all of America, may I say, Virginia Commonwealth University. And and what they do is send out a survey to attorneys. So every year you receive a survey and they ask you whether you have practiced in front of certain judges. And every 3 years, a judge will come up for evaluation. So as an attorney, if you have been before that judge in the last 12 months, you may or may not get a survey on that judge. And if you do, it's probably about 30 questions that they will ask you. It's about their decorum. It's about the time that they spend on cases in the courtroom. It's about their attitudes, even, if you will. And I will say that I forgot when this started, but I know I was back in private practice. And there have been a number of judges that, although a JERC complaint might have been dismissed, when they come up for those evaluations, you may not see them come January of the next year, because they take the surveys and those evaluations so seriously from the attorneys that while they may not necessarily be punished with different trainings or other sanctions, they'll just be removed from the bench.
Wow.
Interesting.
I didn't realize that those evaluations carry such weight. Mm-hmm. But it's nice that, I mean, this is one of the great things about being in law, is that we are a self-policing profession. And there's great responsibility for that. That's why we have these commissions for judges that, judges judging judges and lawyers judging lawyers when it comes to legal discipline as well. But it's only as good as how well we as a profession keep doing that. Kiernan and Joy, when you guys have been talking to judges about this topic, you know, what are their concerns that they express to you about why that they may have not necessarily liability in the strict sense, but more, you know, exposure that they've sure. might have to defend things that could be, you know, personally costly to them.
I can jump in here because Maryland's had our judicial disciplinary insurance policy through Minnesota Lawyers Mutual's RRG for a number of years now. And the reason we started it was because the judges actually approached us where there was a really big matter that made headlines. You know how these things get picked up by the Daily Record and then kind of spread out from there. But we had a Maryland judge who faced an inquiry, and she defended herself, and it cost her, I want to say, six figures out of pocket to defend herself. No. And in the end, she was completely exonerated of the charges filed against her. She then sued the state and said, you know, I'm a government employee. Why did I have to do this? Like, why, you know, what's the, and that didn't go anywhere for her either. So she was completely exonerated and still had to pay out over six figures from her pocket to defend herself and continue to have her position as a judge, which she still is a judge today. And what a, you know, what an awful kind of experience for her, certainly. Judges also don't, you know, these aren't deep pockets, you know, the legal profession, like the days of what Boston Legal kind of are way in the past. These judges at the state level are, you know, government employees that are making state level salaries. So to defend yourself that amount over years as well. I mean, think about the stress and the time and that hanging over her head for that long. So it was a really unpleasant situation. And that really was the catalyst for the judges approaching us and wanting this type of defense-only policy. So since we've implemented it here in Maryland, and like I said, that was a number of years ago, maybe 5 or so years ago, it's been incredibly popular. And I would say a large number, maybe not 100%, but a large number of our judges now have this defense. And that's what we're seeing, again, where other states are going to these online processes, where these types of issues are being picked up by national news outlets and being spread across the country. It can certainly be really scary for a judge to get any type of inquiry. And now, of course, just because they have an inquiry against them or a complaint filed against them, it doesn't mean they've done anything wrong, but they still may have to defend themselves just to provide their side of the story. Because as you mentioned, Todd, a lot of these courtrooms are now being recorded and filmed. So there are avenues for the judges to provide, you know, a full defense if they were acting in their judicial capacity with all due judicial demeanor in these situations. But as you can imagine, and we've seen such bad situations from attorneys and malpractice claims, there are certainly judges who are behaving badly. And if we have time, I can run through a few judges that have made headlines in recent months and years, and you can let me know if you think that they, you know, what kind of discipline they received as a result of these headlines, if you'd like.
Oh, I want to hear. I will ask you this, though. This was before you go into that. We had a judge in the Minnesota Tax Court a few years back that got in some trouble for involving, you know, judicial misconduct, but it was more employment related. And so you had staff and people that felt like the judge was abusive. Mm-hmm. And there was other performance issues where, I mean, if you, some of these things are, you know, are easily trackable, which is, you know, how well, of all the judges, how well is this judge doing staying on their docket, you know, keeping up with their caseload, things like that. But it was really the employment-related cases. And I'm not saying that there was specifically, you know, really bad harassment issues, but just being a really bad boss, you know.
Yeah.
And so people just didn't like to work with this person. And so does this type of coverage is employment related issues as a judge part of what are the issues of concerns? Or
it certainly,
I don't even know
can
if those
be.
Are
I don't want to speak too broadly there about you know, what the employment like categories are for these individuals, but in Maryland, for sure, the commission, you know, anyone can make a complaint against the judge to our commission, and that includes courthouse staff and a number of complaints. Now, the majority of complaints certainly come from the public, but every year on our annual report, I do notice that there are a handful, you know, maybe a dozen, two dozen complaints that are from courthouse staff. There are also complaints made by attorneys as well as other judges. So they do break down the data that they receive to say where these complaints are coming from. And courtroom staff, you know, there's always at least a couple there. So it is a way for judges who are abusive or who are, you know, have some type of harassment going. That's a lot of the cases that we've made that have made the headlines, I guess I should say. You know, those types of bad behavior stories are what really get picked up and spread quickly online. And that really, I mean, not what we want people thinking of when they think of our judicial officers.
Yeah. Well, hey, give us some of those examples that you mentioned. I'd love to hear them.
We have one judge who, well, his defense was that he was making dad jokes, you know, harmless dad jokes.
That's a
what
poor
the what the news article I read says, quote, on multiple occasions, this judge shared sexually themed remarks to attorneys, courtroom personnel, and parties with legal standing, including jokes about ejaculate, about a defendant that would impregnate his defense lawyer, and homoerotic quotes from In Living Color sketches. But dad jokes, just dad jokes.
Yeah, I'm like
trying to bring some levity into this courtroom.
That's
do you
want to
guess,
dad jokes in our house.
You know, what kind of what the outcome here was for this judge? Is this judge still on the bench? Let's say.
Joy, any guesses?
No, he's probably out.
So this judge had been elected to the bench. And this is a state, this is in Florida. So what happened in the end was that he resigned.
So once
a judge resigns, there's really no jurisdiction except criminal. But, you know, once a judge resigns, then the commission who's overseeing this type of conduct, they don't have the jurisdiction to really do more is what I'm finding. It's very state specific again, but that judge in the end has resigned. Now we have another one here who said that he was actually, this judge got selected for jury duty. So kind of a silly situation just in itself, right? The judge who had to go to jury duty.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you go to jury duty, most people try to get out of jury duty. And this judge was no exception. So he asserted that he should not serve on a grand jury because he's a judge. And he, I don't think this is a direct quote, but his defense here was that he thinks people who appear in court are guilty. And he said that he thought people who appear before him did something wrong. That's why they're there.
Oh, my gosh.
So if you got a speeding ticket, you're there because you were speeding. And that's the judge's take on the criminal defendants who come before him.
Oh, my gosh.
He has also resigned.
I was going to say, is this another Florida judge?
Not a Florida judge. That one, oh, I don't have it in my notes. I want to say, oh, it was New York, a New York judge.
Okay, wow.
Now there is a judge here going back to Florida. Yep, okay.
Oh, wow.
So this judge, they're not all from Florida. We can't pick. It's really, it really spreads the U.S. here. You know, every state is represented. This judge in Florida decided to wear a camo robe for deer season. So you'd think you might want to wear, you know, a Margaritaville robe in Florida, but this judge chose a camo-colored robe for deer season. And he
The panhandle area of Florida.
Yes, Todd. You know Miami. Your geography of Florida well. Yeah.
Yes. Where there might be a deer or two. Okay. Sorry
to interrupt. No. He wore it on the bench, and he also wore it to a diversity training. What happened in the end, you're not going to guess this. What happened in the end is that the Florida legislature came out and said, new rule, new law, judges have to wear black robes. Wow. Which is pretty standard across the U.S. I will say that in Maryland, we have our Supreme Court judges sometimes wear red, and that harkens back to, I think, a practice in England. But we are a very old state here, and so we're one of the only ones that doesn't have only black robes.
Yeah, I've noted – well, now we're really getting off topic, but I've noticed that judicial expression, we'll call it, seems to happen in the robes all the way up to the Supreme Court. Rehnquist, I think, was the guy who decided he wanted some gold insignia on his robe to indicate that he was the chief judge. And so one day he showed up and he had the gold armbands and like looking like General Patton. But I don't think Roberts or anybody else decided to do that after Rehnquist was gone. But anyway, I digress.
Speaking of armbands and judicial attire, there was a judge who appeared in his court as Darth Vader.
No.
I don't know if this was Halloween,
right?
Or
yeah, it had
just
to be.
Some kind of dress-up day. But yeah, he appeared live in court in a Darth Vader costume, walking out from his chambers with the Imperial March playing on his cell phone.
Wow.
That did get him in some trouble. However, I think it was probably his failure to secure his judicial chambers when he was changing clothes, when he was also inviting his female coworkers and attorneys into his office that got him publicly reprimanded. So regardless of the Darth Vader costume, he was changing from like gym clothes into his judicial outfits and didn't lock and close the door and had told, you know, someone might have knocked and he said, oh, come in. And he was not fully clothed in more than one situation that happened with the specific judge. Now, this judge also, he has a really thick stack of paperwork, we'll say. So a couple more things to note about this particular Darth Vader judge. He was also reprimanded for inaccurately reporting his vacation and leave time. So he wasn't being honest about the, you know, the PTO that he was taking in the vacation days. But he has also been reprimanded because multiple people complained about his devotion, really obsession with a tabletop role-playing fantasy game. And he would log on and in like a chat room and make hundreds of comments on this chat board about this fantasy role-playing game while he was on the bench between 9 and 5 p.m. So while he was on the bench, supposed to be working, hadn't taken any vacation days this time around, but he was posting on multiple message boards. And I'll read you one quote that he posted apparently while he was at work. And that quote is, "That's right, Big Daddy Orcus is now Big Daddy Smurf. True, true, but a good demon lord doesn't whip and tell." So these were not things that were in any way related to what he should have been doing on the bench.
Wow.
And he was very involved in this fantasy world building. He was privately reprimanded, publicly reprimanded. I believe he still is on the bench today.
Wow. I think you're making a really good case, Kiernan, that having a judicial assignment and wearing the robe doesn't necessarily give you automatically good judgment and behaviors. I mean, people are still people. Let me just say it this way. I think there's few things that rub people wrong any worse than a judge who comes across as I'm better than thou, you know, and especially in behavior that is patently unacceptable. You know, and so there might not have been anything wrong with this judge who got mad at the IT person, but it was a visceral reaction that people have when they see that, which is, you know, you know, by the end of it, he's like, you know, find out who this person's supervisor is, you know? And so people are like, okay, the judge didn't do anything wrong, but society doesn't really seem to, if a judge comes off looking as though they're better than everybody else, and especially, you know, playing games while they're on the bench or any of these other things, that, yeah, people are going to complain. And then the judges have to respond to it, and that can be costly.
And it's also just, I mean, what a normal person can do and what someone who has been appointed and sworn in as a judge can do, because we do hold them to a higher standard. And once you've been sworn in, like I said, you're a judge on and off the bench, even, you know, out in your community, because people do recognize you and you're still held to that standard. And the, you know, the these codes of judicial conduct are so very broad and far reaching, because any argument could kind of be made to say what is prejudicial to the administration of justice. You know, being rude, certainly harassment, certainly implications of bias. You know, there have been terrible issues regarding judges who have had paraphernalia that they shouldn't have visible on their desk, whether that's because of racism or just because it doesn't need to be there and is kind of like mucking up the courtroom. There was a judge I'm thinking of who was kind of called like the game show host, because she kind of got adorned in like all these interesting accessories, but her desk was also, you know, those little things that like sit in the sun and move back and forth, or, you know, like pinwheels, like people, you know, sure, a plant on your desk, that's fine. But when you're in the courtroom, you can't exactly have your desk full of little tchotchkes. So there's such a broad scope of things of, you know, things that judges can get in hot water for, and certainly different people can get offended at different things, but that, you know, what is prejudicial to the administration of justice? What is a judicial code of conduct, you know, upholding there? And it's just, it's so very far far reaching that these judges have to be really, really careful, especially when they're on social media, especially when they're raising their voice in the courtroom, and really any time in between. And because of the trend of these things, these complaints increasing and these complaint systems going online, and the way that this has been a politicized issue, if I was a judge, I would be incredibly, I mean, I would almost be like a robot. You know, you really can't be too human in a way, because you're being held to this standard. But it is a standard that we need, since judges do have some immunity for other things, and we do need to have some oversight of our judges for what they're doing in their courtroom, especially when we're continuing to see issues like harassment that do come up.
Yeah. I've got one last question before we wind this one up for you guys. Who do you think among the three of us would make the best judge?
Can we nominate Beth, who is helping us with the recording?
I know the least one.
Oh, wait. Okay, go ahead. Who would? Well, first of all, I was going to say the one most likely of the three of us to become a judge, that's you, Joy.
No.
Because you're the best connected in your community. And
I could see that.
I could totally see that happening.
Joy would make a great judge.
The reason why I say it the least is if you want my honest, transparent answer, which I'm not sure if the podcast is ready for. After working at the wonderful MLM, I do not want to get dressed every morning. I do not want to start my car up. And I do not want to go inside of a place where I have to now talk to people. I like being at home and talking to you all. So no, I am not. But what I will say,
those virtual hearings though, Joy.
Exactly, right? Well,
You're wearing under the robe.
Sweatpants all the way. One of the things that I will say though, and I think the reason why all three of us would make great judges in our own way is because we have the ability, it's kind of like what you said before about connecting with people. And some of the things that I see in, like, with, you know, with regards to Virginia judges, I have to do, or in Virginia attorneys, we're supposed to do at least 2% pro bono each year. So sometimes I might find myself, you know, taking on a legal aid case here and there. And if I'm going back in the courtroom, I'm so disheartened because even though I might not see the Darth Vader costumes or, you know, these weird Orcus quotes, what I am seeing are, you know, judges who are very, how do I say it, brief, dismissive of some of the people in their courtroom. And it really saddens me that sometimes we still have that. And I think that's what would make us different than some of those judges because of the relatability. It's knowing that at any given time, we could have been on the other side. Our family members, our friends could have been on the other side. And it's just having that empathy for people, knowing that it could have been one simple mistake. Maybe it's a civil matter and they just need assistance in trying to get back something that was lost. And like I said, maybe it might not be as big as some of the examples that Kiernan gave, but my takeaway, if we do have judges that are listening, or if we have those who are aspiring to be judges that are listening, I would hope that they would consider that sometimes people make mistakes. Sometimes people just need our judicial system to help in times of uncertainty. And what we should do is not take these positions lightly at all, because as quick as, you know, my grandmother would say this, as quick as you've been blessed with something is as quick as you can be, as it can be taken away from you. So, you know, kudos to us for having that relatability. And I just hope that judges will continue to do so and have that empathy for people in their courtrooms.
And, you know, I want to say that while we've spoken about these judges who have, you know, rightfully gotten in trouble for making bad decisions, judges are people and they can, you know, they're humans and they make mistakes too. And Joy, you know, we were just at a bench bar conference down in your neck of the woods in Virginia where we met and got to hear from some really incredible, kind and the right people, you know, who you want on the bench. And Maryland has, you know, the judges I work with could not be more kind to the people, and they understand the immense kind of power that they hold in their position, and they do not take that lightly. But again, sometimes these things just come up, and, you know, it's not bad attorneys that have malpractice insurance. It's not bad judges that have judicial disciplinary insurance. It's the way that these things are just happening in our profession right now. So there are by and far incredible judges out there. And I know in Minnesota, Todd, the judges that have been, we talked a little bit in our last episode about ICE and immigration issues. There are certainly judges who are upholding the rule of law and doing everything they can in their positions, which can be a lot, right? But we do need to make sure we rein in these judges who lose track or lose sight of what it's like to be on the other side of their bench.
Well, Kiernan, I don't know about you, but I think we just heard Joy's first judicial campaign speech. So I encourage all the Virginia lawyers out there to write in her name. Make sure you include the hyphen for
I'll
Supreme
be your campaign
Court.
Manager.
Yes, and I think Joy would be a great judge. Well, hey, this has been a great conversation.
Yes.
And lots of interesting changes in this area. So I'm sure we're going to be talking about it again in the future as judicial ethics and liability become more of a concern. So thanks so much, you guys. And thanks to everybody out there who joined us for this podcast. And hey, let's do another one.
Like and subscribe.
Like and subscribe. Yes, that's it. Yes.
All right,
take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Are You at Risk is hosted by Todd Scott, Joy Melvin Griffin, and Kiernan Waters. Production support by Carol Greethurst. Music by Audio Beats. Recorded and edited by Beth K. Gibbs of Lyft Podcasting. For more information, visit mlminns.com. That's mlminns.com.